This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we bring you updates on several of our stories from recent weeks, including a review of the status of Port Townsend's water situation with the ongoing drought. We attend the release after rehabilitation of several of the birds we met at the Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue, and the scion of the nation's oldest carousel-building family talks to us about his plans to instill fun into the lives of some of the world's most traumatized children. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Not too long ago, the idea that the Pacific Northwest might run out of water seemed about as absurd an idea as that the Mojave Desert might run out of sunshine. But when I spoke with Port Townsend Water Resources Manager Ian Jablonski in mid-July, it was in the context of an historic drought that not only presented the city with the possibility of unprecedented water conservation measures, but in fact threatened to force the shutdown of the county's biggest water consumer, the Port Townsend Paper Mill, which on average uses about 12 million gallons of water daily, by contrast to the city's average of only 1 million. The summer continued to be warm and dry, and soon those civic conservation measures were in fact put into place for residents. Jablonski had told me that the trigger point for the shutdown of the mill would be the point that Lord's Lake Reservoir was emptied out. Along with City Reservoir, Lord's Lake is the city's backup water supply for when flows from the Big Quilcene River, the city's usual water source, fall below a minimal level. If the drought continued unabated, he said then, that time was projected to come at around the end of October. There were a few good rainstorms in September, but I had no idea whether they really made up for the complete lack of snowpack in the spring and the continuing drought through the summer, so I decided to go and talk to Jablonski again last week to see where we now stand. My main question is how we are standing here at the beginning of October in terms of water supply for the city and the mill.
We have had a fair amount of rain, more than typical in our watershed, probably 4 to 5 inches since the end of August, and that has kept river flows higher than they would typically be this time of the year. So our drawdown of Lord's Lake has been slower than we have seen in the past.
Oh, that's good. So I was actually out there yesterday. I just went out to see what the level looked like, and it was hard for me to assess. I mean, you could certainly see a lot of bare ground along the shores, but so about what capacity is it standing at now?
We're about 280 million gallons remaining in the reservoir at this time, and we started the year at 570 million gallons.
So is that like a reservoir half empty or half full?
Yes. So, but we have enough water remaining in the reservoir right now to keep the city and the mill operating probably till the end of October at the rate we're currently going.
I guess you've probably been watching the weather forecast rather closely. Now, I know that we're coming into an El Nino year, but just what that means in Washington is hard to say, isn't it?
Well, you can't forecast the weather that much in advance, but it typically provides a drier, warmer year than normal. But I would still expect to see more precipitation or at least more snowfall than we had last year, which was an abnormally low snowfall year.
Yeah, there was basically no snowpack by the end of the season, right, which is unprecedented, I think.
Yeah, we did have some snow, but it rapidly melted with some of the warmer weather that we had. And so most of the El Nino forecasts are in the range of maybe 20% less snow on average. But that doesn't mean that you won't get any snow. So as long as we do get some rain and snow, we should be okay.
All right, so, but you say we have enough water currently in storage to last through the end of October, and I guess you're probably counting on getting some more rainfall before then, but if we don't, then Lord's Lake empties out by the end of the month. Is that right?
It will be fairly close to empty by the end of the month. And typically in October, we see our rainfall start developing, and that's when our fall rains begin, usually around the middle of the month or so.
You know, there was an agreement that the mill would shut down at the point that Lord's Lake emptied out, so I guess you're going to be watching that fairly closely and be in contact with them about that through the month.
Yes, we're meeting with them regularly, and we just had a meeting yesterday, and we'll continue meeting with them regularly as, you know, the year goes on here.
Now, at the point that, I mean, like, say we don't get, I mean, I've been looking at the forecast, and it looks like, once again, we have like a week of sunny days coming up on us. You know, at what point do you decide to pull the plug? I mean, do you wait until the reservoir is empty and you say, okay, this is the moment now? Or are you going to sort of say, well, it's almost there? I mean, how is that going to work?
Well, again, we're going to be talking to them on a weekly basis, and so we'll be keeping advised of, you know, where the reservoir is at, and it won't be like, you know, tomorrow you have to, you know, do this or that. You know, we'll know in advance, you know, usually probably more than a week. And again, it depends. You may, you know, be planning something, and then the next day you get a lot of rain. So it's still a moving situation there.
After my interview with Jablonski, I learned that the Port Townsend paper mill operators have decided to schedule a maintenance shutdown that normally occurs in November for this week, a move that temporarily reduces water usage by two-thirds. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. When I pulled off into the big parking lot at Squim's Gray Wolf Elementary School near the turnoff from Highway 101 to the Dungeness Spit, I found Discovery Bay Wild Bird Rescue Director Cindy Daly and a retinue of other invitees already gathered at this rallying point for the big event. Two bald eagles I had met a few weeks earlier when I had gone to Daly's home to do a story about her amazing bird rescue operation were about to be released into the wild after successful rehabilitation. I'd barely gotten out of the car when Daly rushed up to me, anxious to introduce me to Joseph Molotsky, her star volunteer who had not been present for my original interview.
He's 13, and he's the one I was telling you about. He has raised over $4,000 for the center on his own. He came out and took pictures, and then he had cards made, and he sits out at tables all around Port Townsend and has been selling these cards to that tune of that amount of money. And then he also has gotten contributions from friends and family as well. And he's the one that I was showing you the boxes that he made, remember, in the garage?
Yeah.
All him. This is all Joseph.
Wow. So, Joseph, how did you get started doing this? What made you interested?
I've been interested in birds for, I think I started when I was two. I identified a bird, and I just always have been interested in birds ever since. And then for my bar mitzvah project, I've been working with Cindy.
I see. So for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite part of working with Cindy?
Just being able to see all the birds, because they're just so beautiful.
Do you have a favorite memory or experience?
When I first started holding the birds. And one thing I remember is when we got in a barn owl with a broken wing. Cindy was wrapping the wing. I got to hold it while she did that. That was amazing. Yeah.
And so is this suggesting a career trajectory for you?
I'm thinking about it. Not sure yet.
Joseph's going to be helping with the release of one of the... He's going to be releasing one of the eagles, and then this family over here I'll introduce you to, they plucked the other eagle out of the water in Discovery Bay while on their boat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh. Do you want to talk to them now?
Yeah, sure.
Let me introduce you. This is Dan.
Hi, Dan. Steve Evans.
And Nancy?
Diane.
Diane, excuse me.
Diane.
This is Steve from our local KPTV radio.
Oh, yeah, nice.
He wants to talk to you guys about what you did.
I wasn't there, though.
Oh, you weren't there?
No.
Oh, well,
just Dan. Dan and Robert, didn't make it today.
Oh, so tell me about finding the bird.
We were off North Beach about a mile. And went by, and I couldn't believe there was an eagle in the water. It looked half dead. And we paddled up to it. And it took a it swam away about for two or three strokes, and then it turned around and came right to me. And we were wondering how
it came to you. It swam towards you.
Swam right at me and looked at me. And then we had nothing to pick it up. It was 80 degrees, nothing. So we stuck a paddle under it, and it kind of didn't move. So I stuck the paddle farther underneath it and just lifted it to the front of my boat.
And then it just laid there on the front of the boat?
Sat there and said, what now? It shivered. It was sitting there shaking. And we called my daughter, and she called these guys, and they told me exactly what to do. And we set up a meeting place, and with about 45 or 50 minutes, the bird was off the boat in good hands.
That sounds like surprising behavior for an eagle to just sort of peacefully sit there. So it must have been pretty stressed out.
Yeah, very stressed out, shaking. When we threw a shirt over it, it stopped shaking quite a bit.
So, Cindy, how do we choose this location for releasing the bird?
Well, I think because the Dungeness River has a lot of eagles that gather because of all the fish that are in the waters at this time of year, it's a kind of a great little spot to release them in. And for the youngsters, they can find fish that the older, mature birds are bringing out of the water, and then they kind of go around and scrounge and get the scraps.
I was wondering about that. So there's not a sort of territorial issue when you introduce a strange eagle into a group that's already present?
At this time of year, they gather where there's a good food supply. I think they're going to do fine here.
Well, let's go do it.
Okay.
At this point, everyone climbed back into their vehicles and followed Daly's pickup truck with the two eagles' blanketed cages in the bed a couple of miles down to a pull-off near the entrance to the Dungeness Spit. This was the chosen release point.
Those people probably have them. You can jump up here easily enough. Yeah. We're just going to set them down. They're probably facing that way. We kind of want to let you guys release them at the same time so that they're probably going to go like this and go in the opposite directions, but I'm pretty sure they're going to find each other again and stick together because they've been very closely bonded as they've been together recuperating.
Where did the juvenile come from?
The juvenile came from around Discovery Bay, around Cape George. And just was on the ground, probably left the nest too early. And when we got a call on it, we ran out and caught it. And it was very emaciated, hadn't been taken care of for a while.
Right, they both were emaciated, right?
They both were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and the mature one that he found in the water had the worst infestation of capillaria, which is a parasite, that anybody has ever seen. So he took a long time to recover. And then once he started eating, then it was just my job to keep getting the groceries into him and fatten him up. Yeah. Okay, so are you guys ready? Yeah? Okay. So this one's yours.
Yep.
And you know, the thing about this one is you have to undo the
bunch
parts as well. And then there's your guy. Probably. Hey, buddy, turn around. Turn around.
You just want them to
watch.
Oh, yeah,
I
should be
able to. You guys kind of coordinate 1, 2, 3 or something. You kind of want to let them go together so they kind of. I want the youngster to stay with the mature one.
You tell us when you're ready.
1, 2, 3.
That guy out. There he goes.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
Go.
So they're flying off in slightly different directions.
The wings need to have the muscles in them built up, or can they just fly forever?
They've been flying back and forth. They've been getting stronger and just healthy and ready for release. And as you guys saw, they flew beautifully.
And they're gone.
And they're gone.
Now what?
That's it.
Now
that's
we just never know the end of the story.
We should have sent a good, healthy life blessing to them, right?
I always, to be honest with you, when I grab them up, I always kiss them on the head and say good luck before I put them in the crate. So I know it's kind of bittersweet, right? It happens so fast. It's like all this build up.
It's like all that
I imagine
life is, right?
Yeah, that's it. That was it.
Yeah, how long did you have those birds?
Let's see, how long did I have them? July and August. July, August, and most of September, almost 3 months. And they'll find the river over there and the fish, and they'll find their way. It's always so fun to watch them go. So rewarding. I mean, 3 months of labor of love, right? And then it's like, yeah, okay, they don't even look back and, you know, give me a nod or anything.
That's right. They didn't even look back. They have, like, yeah. I'm out of here.
It's okay. Okay, you guys. Well, thanks for coming. Yeah. I'm glad you got to see it.
Okay, well, thanks for yeah, I really appreciate it.
Okay, see you next week then.
Before we parted, Daly told me she expected to be releasing a great blue heron I had seen in her infirmary the following Saturday. And so it was that 1 week later, I found myself meeting Daly and a few others, this time at Oak Bay State Park on a clear and windy afternoon. Also present were Scott Clogston and Sue Hopkins, who had captured the heron a couple of months earlier in their home adjacent to the park. Clogston told me the story.
I was just sitting there, I was talking to a neighbor lady, and her eyes all of a sudden went all kind of the size of pies, you know, and then I heard this kind of like wings behind me, and this guy just come and sat down. And he looked around a bit. After a while, he stepped down into the yard, and he walked down the side of our house, checked out all the gardens, and he climbed the stairs and got up to the backyard. He was walking across the backyard. The door was open. Looked good to him. He walked in. He checked it all out. He jumped up on the washing machine where we had crab bait thawing, you know. So we didn't know what to do. We called Cindy Daly of Discovery.
So you knew about Cindy Daly?
Oh, yeah, yeah. She rescued a hummingbird for us not too long ago, you know. What was it we said? Wild birds, short and tall, Cindy Daly takes them all. So they, her husband, Connor, showed up in about 15 minutes and packed them up, and off they went, and she's had them for a couple of months.
So was he starving also? It seems like the story is the starving bird this year.
He was. He was emaciated and needed lots of building up. He, you know, initially was dehydrated, so I got him hydrated again. And then it's the process to get him back to eating solid food when they're that thin. And so I have something called piscivore care, which is for fish-eating birds. And I tube the bird basically for almost a full week. And eventually got him back to eating solid food. And all this time, the rest of this time, we've just been putting food calories into him. So
Is he a young bird?
Yeah. He was just this year's baby bird that was born and experienced, lost his way, somehow got displaced from his family. And so he ended up, looking for help in someone's home, which is unusual, I would say.
Have you had that happen before?
I have not had that happen before. And now Sue and Scott get to let him go and see him return to where he came from. Take him. I'm going to let you guys release him.
Oh, Lord. I cannot hear him pointing in that direction. Yeah, no kidding. Hey, you got to get him when it was easy. Now he's healthy and I have to do it?
That's right.
Jeez.
Isn't that exciting? Okay, so Scott, I guess we're going to... you need to watch that beak because it's sharp, that, obviously. Yeah. So I would say, let me grab him first, though. Come here, dude. And I'll hand him to you. All right. Come here. Don't hurt anything. Come here. Okay. All right, so first I want you to see how nice and feel that along the keel there, how nice and fat he is.
Yeah.
Okay, that was sharp as a knife.
Wow.
When he came in.
Excuse me.
Okay, so I'm just gonna get his wings in here. Okay. Yeah. And I just kind of want to hold that, give him a chance to see what you're doing, yeah. And then just kind of let him go.
Whoa. Oops.
There he goes.
Oh, he's lifted off.
Yeah, he got a little, you know, being handled. That made him nervous.
Yeah, it made me nervous.
Oh, look, somebody's squawking at him. There's the other one over there already squawking at him.
Yeah. There he goes.
Woo, baby. You are free. Oh.
Oh, he's come to a landing on a nice little sprit of sand there.
He looks familiar to him. This is where he came from.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's settled right down. He looks right at home.
Yeah. So now he'll just have to get used to being out free again. And it always feels so good. You can just tell. They love being released.
We were about to head for home when we noticed that the newly released heron was being attacked by a much larger, fully mature heron, which chased him off his sand spit and over a rise out of view.
Uh-oh. It begins.
The territory begins. You get out of here, youngster. He's being chased.
The bully heron then rose and fell violently several times on the spot where the newly released bird had gone down. Fearing the worst, our whole group rushed to the edge of an estuary that divided us from the marsh where the violence was happening, and then, still not able to see, Cindy, Scott, and Sue waded across, soaking shoes and trousers, before, to everybody's relief, we saw our bird flying off, apparently unscathed, although there was some disagreement as to whether he had injured his left leg.
He doesn't just lift straight off, he kind of limps with it.
Huh. Well, he's not, I can't really see him. He's not doing anything right now.
Right, he's not doing anything.
There he goes. He's just...
He's kerfuffled.
Yeah, no, he's fine.
Good.
Yeah, he's fine. He's fine.
Good.
Reassured by Daly's assessment, we all said our goodbyes and the party broke up, although my wife and I lingered for another hour or so, watching seabirds and distant sailboats heeling amid the whitecaps, and occasionally checking on our heron, which had taken up a classic pose of watchful waiting at the water's edge. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News.
One more. Is there one more? He can double up with someone if he wants. It's okay? All right. Okay, here we go.
A few weeks ago, KPTZ correspondent Monica Fletcher caught up with Port Townsend resident Bill Denzel, the fifth-generation heir to the legendary Denzel Carousel Company, as he prepared, as he does each year, to set up his self-built trailer-mounted merry-go-round for the Wooden Boat Festival. And so it was that Monica and I decided to stop by the carousel at the festival to see the colorful contraption in action. And as happy children from toddlers to teens lean from their hand-carved mounts to try to grab brass rings from a dispenser, and other kids hammered away on toy boats in the background, we chatted with Denzel, and he told us of his plans to bring fun into the lives of less lucky children in a faraway land.
Well, I have this portable carousel here, but I also have what I call a stationary carousel that I've been working on over the years. In storage in my backyard by my workshop, and it's a complete carousel, and it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. There's plenty of kids out there that can, you know, ride a carousel and would enjoy to ride a carousel. The kids that I notice the most are the ones that have the least, and I see photographs of some areas where they really don't have much or anything at all, and one of them is Palestine or the West Bank or Gaza, that area. And I'm just thinking the origins of the carousel are in the Middle East. The Crusaders, oh, 1,000 years ago, saw this clever idea, brought it to Europe, put it in the castles for training the knights, and eventually, after hundreds of years of keeping it secret, brought it out, and the royalty got to use them at first, and then the regular people like my family in southern Germany got to make them. My wagon maker family started making them, and they made it across the ocean to America, then made it across America all the way to Port Townsend. And I'm in this wonderful, peaceful place, but I know the whole world is not like that. And these kids are really loving the ride, but kids everywhere would love the ride. And I love providing the ride for these kids here, but I would also like to provide the ride for some other kids that really can't even dream of something like this. I know they would love it.
How would you get that carousel clear to Palestine? That must pose a lot of problems.
It's an interesting learning experience. I've been researching that. I'm working with a couple of groups that already have some playground projects going on over there. But it's amazing what you learn once you start to dig into how do you really do this. It's very complicated. It's highly restricted and watched area. So you have to go through the proper channels and work with proper people. Do it in the right area, because there's areas where, forget it, you don't even try. You're not going to get there. As much as I would like to get a carousel into Gaza, it was actually my original idea to get this very carousel here, this portable one, into Gaza, where they could move it around to different little parts of Gaza where they, you know, where there's villages and what's left of towns and things, and they could operate, have a portable carousel. It would create a business. I mean, I want to donate it. I mean, I'm raising money to finish up the project and donate what we do. So, you know, there's not, it's not a profit-oriented thing, but it is a, it's more of a message than anything to those people over there that, hey, guess what? There's people here actually thinking about you, and it's not just, you know, we're not just talking about it, and we're thinking about real things. And of course, someone could say, oh, we should be sending, you know, hospital equipment or food or something. Well, there's other groups doing that, but I think the fantasy of a child as they grow up is a really important thing. And if you want to have happy people and have happy adults, well, a good way to start is by having happy children and recognizing their world and empowering them, so to speak. So, yeah, I want to work with the Port Townsend Carousel Association, which is a nonprofit, local nonprofit group, which I'm a big part of, and get this project off the ground here and work with other people on the ground over in Jerusalem, who I've already communicated with, and this group in Pennsylvania also, and another group in over in the West Bank in Ramallah.
So how long have you been working on this?
Well, this has been probably in me for years. I mean, I was in Israel in 1977. Yes, that's the year. Wonderful time. I was in Haifa Harbor on a boat. So I'm a boat guy. I was working on a big 200-foot boat there. And I hitchhiked all over Israel and Sinai, which was part of Israel at the time. And I've just seen it go downhill. And it really disturbs me because it's such a beautiful area and wonderful people. And I know it's not the majority of people that are doing this. It's a minority. The majority of people are suffering. And I'm trying to send a message, like a real physical, clear message to the children. To me, the carousel crosses all boundaries of politics and religion. I mean, it's just, there's nothing about it that is controversial other than, you know, if you don't like children.
Right. It totally prioritizes children.
Exactly.
So it sounds like you've got the carousel so far along the way. There must still be great costs in pulling this off.
There are, you know, we're 80% there, but to bring it all the way home, we need to finish off the machine in a way that it can be, you know, used publicly, which means it has to be able to handle 12-year-old boys. They are our test group. So, yeah, we need to finish up the loose ends on the carousel. We need to get some materials for the roofing of a pavilion. We need to get container shipping, which is about $6,500 to get it over there to Ashdod, Israel. Yeah, there's expenses. So we're raising money with our group. And then when we get the carousel set up here, we'll operate it here, just, you know, do our test run here, and then take it back apart, get it in the container. This is, you know, something that needs to happen. You know, because those kids are devastated. They're so traumatized. They have PTSD. They're all messed up. You know, they've been really hammered. Really, really hammered. Physically and mentally. You know, so that's what I'm trying to do. You know, peace and love for the children, basically. You know, it might sound hippy-dippy, but whatever. It's the real thing, and it's what we need. Otherwise, we're going to tear the planet apart. It's as simple as that. Okay, we got a parent here that thinks their kids are done. Okay, those are the twins.
All right, thanks so much.
To find out more about Denzel's Carousel for Palestine project, you can go to the denzel.com website. That's DENTZEL.com. This is Steve Evans with Monica Fletcher reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans and Monica Fletcher. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.